You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, January 14th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the secrets and lies of the 2008 bailout with Matt Taibbi, writer from Rolling Stone magazine. Also on the program today, the president just finished or is still engaged in a press conference where he addressed the debt ceiling in an impressive fashion I don't think we've seen him do at any time in his presidency. Also on the program today, Pat Robertson continues to be insane, but has a large platform. We'll get to that piece about inequality supposedly being a good thing in the attempts to lay the table for cuts in our social insurance programs in this country. And... Before we get to any of that, I really don't know how to talk about this. It's really an incredibly sad story and depressing and outrageous. And I think many of you are probably aware that over the weekend, Aaron Swartz died of suicide at age 26. I knew Aaron not well. I met him through a mutual friend. He was producing as one of the many things that he was involved in. He was helping to produce a podcast Ben Wickler had done that I think it's the Flaming Sword of Justice. So they used our office, and we helped them out with the technology to the extent that they needed help from us. He really is an amazing, or was an amazing individual, who at age 14 helped develop RSS, the really simple syndication. It's a web protocol. He was one of the guys who built Reddit, or he had a company that got folded into it. He founded Demand Progress. He was part of the PCCC. He was a big part of the Stop SOPA battle that was waged. I mean, this is just a fraction of what he did in his short 26 years. He developed the architecture for the Creative Commons licensing system. He was under intense pressure from the U.S. government and was facing a trial to put him in prison for up to 35 years. and millions of dollars worth of fines for what amounted to more or less a trespass, moving freely available academic journals into a more freely available database. You can read in other places, as and maybe as the show continues or this week, we will address the specific charges. But you can read just about anywhere. We'll put a series of links of people from Cory Doctorow to Lawrence Lessig, Glenn Greenwald, Matt Stoller. I mean, others, countless numbers of people have written about him and what he was subjected to. One piece that Matt Stoller wrote, who was pretty friendly with him, I think is really is an important piece. And I want to read probably more of it than, you know, I normally would. I mean, it's really heartbreaking. This whole thing is just, it's just heartbreaking. He was a very sweet guy. I didn't know him that well, but just from the time that I spent with him a couple hours in this office and in a lunch or two, was just a very, just an incredibly soft-spoken, impressive individual. Let me read just a little bit from what Matt Stoller wrote, and I encourage you to read the whole thing and to follow the links, and because this guy was a very impressive individual, and it's just heartbreaking. Matt Stoller wrote, "Aaron Swartz was my friend. I will always miss him. I think it's important that as we remember him, we remember that Aaron had a much broader agenda than the information freedom fights for which he had become known. Most people have focused on Aaron's work as an advocate for more open information systems because that's what the feds went after him for, or because he's well understood as a technologist who founded Reddit and invented RSS. But I knew a different side of him. I knew Aaron as a political activist interested in healthcare, financial corruption, and the drug war. We were working on a project on that just before he died. He was a great technologist for sure, but when we were working together, that was not all I saw." He goes on, "He was driven by a desire for justice and not just for open information. He wanted to end the drug war. He wanted financial system not dominated by Bob Rubin, and he wanted monetary policy run to help ordinary people. Aaron believed passionately in the scientific method as his guide for organizing our society. In that open-minded but powerful critique, he was a technocratic liberal. His leaning sometimes moved him towards more radical postures because he recognized that our governing institutions had become malevolent, but he was not an anarchist." Now, you should know that he suffered from depression. And Stoller cites a statement from Swartz's family and partner. "Aaron's death is not simply a personal tragedy. It's the product of a criminal justice system rife with intimidation and prosecutorial overreach. Decisions made by officials in the Massachusetts U.S. Attorney's Office and at MIT contributed to his death. The U.S. Attorney's Office pursued an exceptionally harsh array of charges carrying potentially over 30 years in prison to punish an alleged crime that had no victims. Meanwhile, unlike JSTOR, MIT refused to stand up for Aaron and its own community's most cherished principles." JSTOR, incidentally, dropped charges, dropped any civil actions, said that they were fine. They had settled, essentially, with Aaron and had released just this month over 4 million of those documents for public access. Stoller says, "I want to make a few points about why it's not just sad that he's gone, but a tragedy, a symbol for all of us and a call to action. Aaron suffered from depression, but that's not why he died. Aaron is dead because the institutions that govern our society have decided that it's more important to target geniuses like Aaron than to nurture them. Because the values he sought, openness, justice, curiosity, are values these institutions now oppose. In previous generations, people like Aaron would have been treasured and recognized as the remarkable gifts as they are. We do not live in a world like that today, and Aaron would be the first to point it out. If he could observe the discussion happening now, that the pressure he felt from the oppressive government is felt by millions of people every year. I'm glad his family have not let the justice system off the hook and have not allowed his suicide to be medicalized or the fault of one prosecutor. What happened to Aaron is not isolated to Aaron, but it's the flip side of corruption he hated. What killed him was corruption. Corruption isn't just people profiting from betraying the public interest. It's also people being punished for upholding the public interest. In our institutions of power, when you do the right thing and challenge abuse of power, you end up destroying a job prospect, an economic opportunity, a political or social connection, or an opportunity for media. If you are truly dangerous and brilliant, subversive, as Aaron was, you are bankrupt and destroyed. There's a reason whistleblowers get fired. There's a reason Bradley Manning is in jail. There's a reason the only CIA official who's gone to jail for torture is the person, John Kirikou, who told the world the reason... who told the world that it was going on. There's a reason those who destroy the financial system dine at the White House, as Lawrence Lessig put it. There's a reason former Senator Russ Feingold is a college professor, whereas Senator Chris Dodd is now a multimillionaire. There's a reason DOJ officials do not go after bankers who illegally foreclose and then get jobs as partners in white-collar criminal defense. There's a reason no one has been held accountable for decisions leading to the financial crisis or the war in Iraq. This reason is the modern ethic in American society that defines success as climbing up the ladder. Consequences be damned. Corrupt self-interest, when it goes system-wide, demands that it protects renters from people like Aaron, that it intimidate, co-opt, humiliate, fire, destroy, and or bankrupt those who stand for justice. In 6 days, on January 18th, it's the one-year anniversary of the blackout of Wikipedia, and some have discussed celebrating it as Internet Freedom Day. Maybe we should call this Aaron Swartz Day in honor of this heroic figure. While what happened that day was technically about the Internet, it should be remembered, and Aaron should be remembered, in the context of social justice. That day was about a call for a different world, not just protecting our ability to access websites. We should remember these underlying values. It would help people understand that justice can be extremely costly and that we risk much when we allow those who do the right thing to be punished. Somehow we need to rebuild a culture that respects people like Aaron and turns away from the greed and rent extraction that he hated. What I do know is that if we are to honor Aaron's life, we will recognize him as a broad social justice activist who cared about transforming our society and acted to do so. We will take up his fight as our own. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Matt Taibbi. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You know, it's the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks. With more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers, you, as a listener of the Majority Report, are eligible for a free audiobook download at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Go and pick up The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and the Reality by Chris Mooney. We interviewed him on it a while back. Perfect book for today. You can get a free version at audiblepodcast.com/majority report, or you can pick any one of their hundreds of thousands of titles. Do it now. It's free.
Ooh, yeah. Well, I turn my feelings on. I turn my feelings on the side. Yeah, yeah. And like I'm gonna ignite, I saw them stars go off. I saw them stars go off at night.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program from Rolling Stone, author of several best-selling books, if I'm not mistaken. Matt Taibbi, welcome to the program, Matt.
How's it going, Sam?
It's going pretty good. You got several best-selling books, yes?
The last two. We're bestsellers, I believe. Yep.
That's not bad. Two for two on the last two books. So you got a big piece. I think it's coming out in the print edition of Rolling Stone this week. The Secret and Lies of the Bailout. When we're talking about the bailout, of course, essentially we're talking about that piece of legislation known as TARP and everything that sort of emanated from it. It was passed in basically two tranches. The first was in 2008 during the presidential campaign.
Right.
You talk about just a myriad of secrets and lies that not only have followed its implementation, but really were responsible for its passing. Remind us of how that bill passed and under what circumstances and what we were told at the time.
Yeah, that's one of the really interesting things about this is people forget that we had to approve the bailout, and that when it first went to Congress, it was a three-page proposal written by the Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson, and it essentially gave him unlimited powers and said that there could be no review by any regulatory authority of anything that happened in the bailout, and it was a Beavis and Butthead episode. It was like, can you give us some money? And that's really all it said. And that got rejected by Congress. And there were primarily two wings of Congress that objected to it. It was conservatives who didn't like the sort of handing out welfare aspect of the bill. And then there were progressives who didn't like the helping out Wall Street guys who would ruin the economy aspect of it. So to win over the progressives, what they did is they tweaked the bill, and they said, what we're going to do is we're going to make this bailout. We're going to buy up a whole bunch of bad mortgages, and then since we're going to own them, we're going to modify them. And this was written right into the original TARP bill. It's Section 109. It essentially mandates the government to enact a major program of foreclosure reform, and that was enough. That basically got a lot of people in the Progressive Caucus and particularly in the Congressional Black Caucus to vote for the bill. And then, like 3 days later, after the bill passed, they just unilaterally changed the entire TARP plan. They threw out the idea of buying up troubled assets completely. And replaced it with this new thing called the CPP, the Capital Purchase Program, which essentially meant we were going to dump lots of money into the balance sheets of banks with no strings attached. So people forget that. The process was kind of repeated again when they did the second tranche of TARP. Again, they were promised that there was going to be this foreclosure relief program. Again, they were promised there was going to be this program of lending that went along with the bailouts, and they ditched all that, and we didn't get any of that. Basically, we got like 1% of that.
So let's just stop here and just like make it really clear so that people understand. We had a situation, and I also want to address just how real of this situation you perceive it to be. But we had a situation where we had these mortgages that were basically failing. You had people who were unable to pay for their mortgages. You had, and these mortgages, as people should well know by now, were securitized, and they were owned by the banks and other investors. And so there's two ways that you can approach this problem. One is you can go to the root of it and say that the what has now been sort of commodified and securitized, we're going to shore that end of it up. We're going to go in and actually deal with the mortgages and fix them by modifying them on that level. Or we're going to save the securities or basically fund the loss or make up for the losses that people have lost in terms of the securities. And it was sold to Congress as doing the former, and it was a huge bait and switch, and they ended up doing the latter.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. What a lot of people don't realize is that the financial crisis was not just about failing mortgages, but it was also about other assets and products that were pegged to those failing mortgages. So you had these giant bundles of securitized mortgages, and then you had basically like bets on these mortgages. To stave off defaults, they could have just fixed the mortgages, which would have prevented the defaults and the bets as well. And they didn't do that. I mean, there's no me print, so I think you know. You did that calculation that you could have paid off every subprime mortgage in America in full for like $1.4 trillion. But the bailouts ended up being, much far, far beyond that, because what we were really doing was paying off, default swaps and other stuff that were pegged to those failing mortgages. So, yeah,
and so
it was. It
those
was a
huge side
bait
bets,
and switch.
Those side bets, had we gone in, I mean, the analogy would essentially be as if you had somebody at the blackjack table or the poker table, and they were going for that that inside straight, and we could have stepped in and given them the seven that they needed for that inside straight, let's say.
Right,
and
exactly.
All the people who were doing side bets, they may not have won at that point. They would have had to take some type of haircut because we had provided that seven, but they wouldn't have been wiped out necessarily.
Right.
We would have salvaged that person's hand and mitigated the losses of those side bets. Instead, we tried to go after the numerous side bets, but still the while you still have that inside straight that was not being made. And so it just sort of rippled throughout the whole process of these side bets. Let me ask you this before we go any further with this. Give me your sense of how big how real the crisis was in those days, or how real it was perceived to be. I mean, because a lot of people still suggest that we should have done nothing. And I am leaning from sort of agnostic to actually, I don't think we could have done nothing. I think that there was at least a sense that there was something real that was going on. But give me your sense from your reporting.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think most people on Wall Street will say that, if they didn't rescue AIG, there would have been a huge problem. They did nothing in the instance of Lehman Brothers, and they probably did that just because Hank Paulson personally didn't like Dick Fuld, the guy who ran Lehman Brothers. And that created a huge chain reaction of problems. And when that went down, what people realized is that the system is now so interconnected, that all these banks are so tied to each other because, one of them will be relying on the other for $100 billion in rolling loans on one day, and the next one will have, $50 billion or something hedged with the next bank over. And so if one of these guys collapses, it sets off this chain reaction. And the truth of the matter is that nobody knew. Nobody had any clear sense of what would happen if these institutions started disappearing from the planet. If suddenly Goldman and Morgan Stanley and Citigroup started disappearing, which was totally possible at that time, nobody had any idea what the consequences could be, and it probably would have been really, really bad. So
I had a friend who was working.
I'm not in the camp of doing nothing.
I had a friend who was working at Citibank at the time, fairly well placed up in one of their, I think it was in the consumer credit division, and apparently she had basically called her husband at one point and said, take as much money out of the ATM as you possibly can.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there was a real – I mean, at the very least, they believed there was something really disastrous that was literally – I mean, I wouldn't even say on the horizon. I mean, it was even closer than that. Whether or not they were accurate or not, I don't know if that's something we can ever know. But there was clearly – a panic, and to a certain extent, the idea that the first TARP would not pass was, in some respects, fairly courageous. I mean, I don't want to build up these lawmakers in any way, but on some level, that was fairly courageous that they basically said, "No, we need to put conditions on this."
Right. Yeah. No. It was high stakes poker, no doubt. I mean, Paulson came in. And he sat people down, and senators and congressmen and congresswomen, and he came and he basically asked for the whole store with no conditions. And just reflexively, I think a lot of people in Congress just objected to the idea of that. And they Paulson was saying things like, we're going to lose $500 billion in wealth by 2 p.m. today. If you don't do something to shore up the money markets. He said this once in an 11 o'clock meeting before TARP got passed. And so people didn't know what to think, but they didn't completely trust the guy either. And they wanted some assurances that they were going to do something, to help ordinary people too, before they just, handed over the keys to the Treasury to the guys who had just destroyed the private economy. So
now when we talk about
right.
When we talk about Section 109, and this is the one that would have it would have begun a program, not unlike, I think, what we had during the New Deal, which was a program to buy up mortgages and modify those mortgages. Like you said, that even if they had bought up every single one of them, we're talking about less than $2 trillion, which is a fraction of what we ultimately spent to keep these banks afloat. There's been reports in the past, and Barney Frank has been quoted on this, that basically come down to the idea that Paulson had said, we will do that if President Obama, who I guess was, not quite president-elect at that time, or would be soon to be president-elect, gave us, signed off on it. That he had to use some of his political cash,
capital.
Yes, to have that happen. Does that comport with what you know? Is that give me your sense of that?
Well, I don't know about that specifically. I do know that when after Obama got elected, he did agree to he backed that idea. In part, he had Larry Summers send this letter to the Congress, which outlined something that was a little bit different. They talked about using some of the TARP money to administer a new foreclosure relief program, and that turned into HAMP. But it was different than the original conception, which was we were just going to buy up mortgages and then modify them ourselves. Instead, the new program was we were going to give a bunch of money to banks so that they could modify mortgages. So it wasn't exactly the same concept when Obama, after he won the election. But it was similar, but not quite the same.
And that letter was basically to pave the way for the second tranche of TARP money that
right.
had yet to be released to deal with the skepticism that Congress was expressing because the first tranche of TARP money didn't fulfill its promise. I mean, was there, at that time, I don't remember the outrage or hearing about the outrage regarding Section 109. It just seemed to sort of melt away.
Yeah, it was strange. There was like no uproar about it. It was just kind of announced to us that, oh, we have to do it this other way because, you know, the credit markets are freezing up, so the banks need a whole lot of money, and, you know, don't ask us why, but that's the way it's got to be. So, and so they replaced the original TARP program with this new thing that they literally like scratched in the back of a napkin in a couple of days. This capital purchase program where they gave, 9 banks $125 billion, within, you know, a couple of weeks, basically. And ostensibly this was because there was panic in the markets and people were afraid to lend, they were afraid to do business, and they thought that they were going to dump a lot of money into these banks to provide them with the liquidity that they needed to feel confident about engaging in business with each other and lending to each other. We subsequently found out that that's not what was really – the money was really needed for. What was actually happening is that the companies were broke and they were desperately needed cash to avoid going bankrupt. But that's what it was sold to us as, is, you know, we need to grease the wheels of commerce by, you know, throwing $125 billion at 9 companies. And it was just weird that, you know, nobody really said anything about it at the time.
And so while the credit markets might have loosened a little bit, there was nobody willing to go and borrow money anyways because there was no economic activity.
Right. Yeah. No, that was another really strange thing about it. This whole thing, you know, I remember talking to Paul Kanjorski, the former Pennsylvania congressman at the time, and he was, you know, heavily involved in the negotiations for this. And he was saying this, like, this was an explicit promise. It was like we sat down with these guys and they were kind of chastened at the time and they were looking at us sort of sheepishly. And it was like, we're going to make you guys well again, you know, but there's a quid pro quo. You got to land, you got to kickstart the economy, you got to create jobs. And they were like, sure, absolutely. And that was sort of the implicit underlying deal that was behind the bailout. But it just didn't turn out to be that way at all. And, you know, that was part of the Summers letter as well. It was explicitly laid out that we would not give any money to any banks that did not agree to lend above a certain level. None of them agreed to and ended up doing that. And beyond that, we didn't even institute any kind of program to check if they were lending. There was no monitoring of that at all, it turned out. So the whole thing was just weird. It was just like they said a whole bunch of stuff to placate the Congress, and then they just went and did what they wanted once they got the money.
And out of that second tranche, HAMP was developed, which is the home. What is it? The
God, I don't even remember the
acronym.
I have to look it up. Something mortgage program. Yeah.
And
home assistance. Yeah.
This turned out to be a disaster. In addition to being none of the funds ended up being used. It turned out also to be more of a disaster than anything else. The banks were using it as a way of sort of almost doing a bait and switch on people who were having problems with their mortgage.
Oh, yeah. They would do things like, you know, tell people that they had to stop making payments so that they could be in default. Or they would keep them in default for 9 months and then ultimately reject their modification anyway. And the banks would – the way it worked is the banks would receive certain kinds of – a certain amount of money for making an attempt to modify a mortgage. And they didn't actually have to go all the way through with the modification, it turned out, or there was a way to kind of pull back at some point. And so the program was deeply flawed, in addition to the fact that there was almost no money that actually got spent on it. It turned out later, and this is one of the things I thought was really amazing, you know, four years later, when I'm looking at this, they've only spent $4 billion total on this HAMP program. And if you remember, this was the thing that like got Rick Santelli all freaked out, and that was what started the Tea Parties, was the announcement of this foreclosure relief program.
Rick Santelli being the CNBC commentator who sat on the floor of the Chicago, I think, Commodities Exchange. And just
got
a bunch of traders to say, we don't want to pay any losers' mortgages.
Exactly. Yeah, he was that whole rant about the people who drink the water and carry the water, and you know we don't want to give money to the water drinkers, and so you know this is after we've already given like $450 billion of welfare to you know these irresponsible companies that had wrecked the crisis. Now we haven't even actually given any money out yet to any homeowners, and it like inspires a nationwide revolt overnight because of this Tea Party thing, which was really amazing. That was really the only popular resistance to the bailout that came until the Occupy movement. And the amazingly ironic thing was, you know, they originally allotted $50 billion for this, and it turned out that they only spent $4 billion of it to date. So it was, you know, it works out to be less than 1% of TARP, and TARP, of course, was probably, you know, 10% of the whole bailout if you look at all the other programs that were involved.
And in terms of where the money that the banks got was spent, they didn't actually end up spending it or lending it out. They parked it at the Fed under a program that had started a couple years earlier, which basically gave them, we lent them money at 0% interest. They lent it back to us at some other interest greater than zero, and just basically made money off the money we lent them from us.
Right. Yeah. That was that happened throughout, and there was that, and then there was you know interest we actually just paid on money that was parked at the Fed. You know, banks have always been required to keep a certain amount of money at the Fed as reserves just to prove that they have, you know, liquidity, that they have money in the bank, so to speak, so that they can lend. And we never paid them interest for that stuff because, you know, you shouldn't have to pay somebody money to meet your regulatory requirements. That's not the way it works. But in 2006, it somehow got decided that not paying them interest was an opportunity cost for the banks. So this is sort of like that same concept of regulatory taking. You ever heard about this thing, you know, where like if you have a zoning law that prevents somebody from building a skyscraper in the middle of, you know, your town, then you owe the person the amount of revenue they could have had mm-hmm. from that skyscraper. That's what the banks argued about the money they were forced to park at the Fed. They said, if you don't pay us interest, then you're taking from us because we could have used that money for something else. So they started paying them interest on the money they kept at the Fed, but it was really low interest, like a quarter point a year. And it turned out that the banks were so afraid to lend in the actual economy that after the bailout, suddenly there was like more than $1 trillion in money parked at the Fed, just collecting that quarter point of interest a year. So the more money than we actually spent on TARP ended up sitting in the Fed doing nothing and not contributing to the economy at all. I know it's a convoluted explanation, but what it really means is that we dumped all this money in the economy only to have it end up back in the Fed doing nothing right away.
And paying interest on that money.
And paying interest on it, right. Yeah, exactly.
To the, I really have a problem with the regulatory taking that doesn't allow me to rob some banks. And I think of all the money, I could be living lavishly right now if I didn't have these darn regulations that says I can't go into a bank and say, give me a bunch of $5 bills unmarked in a bag or something.
It's an opportunity cost.
It definitely is.
Yeah,
it definitely is. We could have a much. I can only think of what I would be using that money for here in the office. So we have this. So once we get beyond the process of how they got the money, based upon essentially a massive bait and switch program, where they claimed to lawmakers that it was going to be used for X and it ended up being used for Y. What were some of the bigger lies that took place over the course of the program that was also fib? I mean, I guess one of them is, of course, the bonuses.
Yeah, I mean, there were. See, this was, it's actually kind of a hard story to write because it's sort of a subtle thing that people that's hard to explain. But there was this moment in time after the bailouts got passed, and Neil Borofsky, the bailout inspector, calls this the original sin of the bailout. There was this moment where they decided kind of collectively that we have to lie on behalf of the banks. That in particular, it was right after they chucked the idea of buying up all the mortgages and they did this capital purchase program. They announced that they were only going to give the money to banks that were healthy and solvent. But it turned out that the banks weren't healthy and solvent, that they lied about that. And they made a decision to start altering their regulatory appraisals of how solvent these companies were. So Citigroup, which was basically insolvent, you know, there's this rating system called CAMELS, which it goes from 1 to 5 with, I think 1 being the best and 5 being failing. They gave them a 3 when they should have been at a 5, because they otherwise couldn't justify giving them emergency assistance. And so it sounds like a minor thing, but what ended up happening was there was like mission creep from this. They, you know, the justification was we have to pretend that these companies are healthy, otherwise there'll be panic and people will pull their money out of the system. So they started doing things like accepting bad accounting. They started not prosecuting people for fraud. They started doing all these things. They committed themselves to vouching for companies that were bankrupt, corrupt, and had other problems. And that is what we have now, which is the really dangerous thing, which is this situation where everybody believes that the government is standing behind these companies, and that's why their stock prices are still high. It's not necessarily because people believe the companies are in good shape. It's because they believe that we're going to stand behind them no matter what happens, and that's the bad part.
Yeah, so we basically it's like going in to see the doctor, and the doctor's examines you. He gives you a clean bill of health, and he's also saying, like, you know, but the one things I'm not looking for, like, you know, cancer or, you know, arthritis or any type of tumors, those things we're not going to include in this calculation. You're healthy. So,
right.
Yes, you should you're now available for any type of program we can sign you off for. And the problem, of course, is that we're back to where we were. But we are in some respects more handicapped in terms of our ability to get these banks to do anything because all of their viability is so tied to being propped up by our government now that it limits the options that our government has to reform these banks.
Right. Yeah, I know. Exactly. So if J.P. Morgan Chase were to explode tomorrow or Wells Fargo, then, you know, it would have massive repercussions for the rest of the economy, and they know that. So, you know, how aggressively are we going to regulate any of these companies? I mean, we saw the results of this mindset just last month when they decided not to prosecute anybody from either UBS or HSBC. The particularly amazing example was HSBC, which had been caught laundering, you know, as much as $9 billion for Mexican drug cartels, for terrorist organizations. They had a phony traveler's checks program that allowed Russian mobsters to wash their money. They had a bearer share account program that allowed tax cheats to hide their money. They basically did everything illegal that, like, a bank can possibly do. And we decided not to prosecute them. And the official justification was that this was a systemically important institution, and we can't risk the repercussions that would come from criminal prosecutions of this company. So that's that's what I'm talking about. There's like mission creep. You start by lying about the accounting at Citigroup, and then you end up by letting somebody, you know, the Sinaloa drug cartel, launder $800 million through HSBC. You know what I mean?
Well, what do you got? You got a problem with banks just providing full service? That's what full service banking is, isn't it? That's we give you the full complement of money laundering opportunities.
Exactly.
And so now, I mean, really, there's nothing that the banks can't do. I mean, so what do you have a sense when you talk to people in this industry? What is going to be, does anybody out there have a sense of what the next sort of massive failure is going to be? I mean, or is it just a question of waiting until they settle on what the new bubble will be?
Yeah, I mean, it can be anything. It could be mortgages all over again. It could be student loan debt. It could be commercial real estate. It could be all kinds of things. But the main problem is that because all of these companies are you know, have access to basically limitless amounts of free money from the Federal Reserve, that they've started to do the same thing that they did before the crisis in 2008, which is the term you always hear is recklessly chasing yield, right? So what that means is you're constantly in search of higher earning money-making opportunities. So you're pulling because interest rates are zero and there's no longer any opportunity to really make money betting on safe things anymore or keeping money stashed away. What they've ended up doing is pushing their money into increasingly more and more exotic instruments. You know, we saw this with the London whale bets last year with JP Morgan Chase. I talked to a bunch of academics who explain that, you know, the financial assistance makes these guys go after riskier and riskier investments all the time. And that's what happened in, you know, before the crash. Before the crash, what happened was all these, you know, this ability to securitize mortgages created so much money that they were constantly looking for, you know, higher and higher yields, and so that's why subprime mortgages became so popular, because they were a way to you know, they yielded a lot of money. They were risky, but they were, you know, an investment that was making them the amount of money they needed to make to compete with everybody else. So
so we had these two opportunities.
Saying we've created this risky marketplace.
We had these two opportunities to create moral hazard. One was on behalf of individual mortgage owners, or homeowners, I guess, who had these mortgages, where if their mortgage somehow got modified, that theoretically they could go out and, I guess, the next mortgage they got or whatever, they would be perfectly happy to take on more debt than they could sustain, or they wouldn't question again whether or not, hey, my income is X, you're telling me to put down Z. Or just that we would basically put into the hands of essentially what amount to some type of addict class, mm-hmm. where they're addicted to higher and higher returns, the knowledge that they can never lose money on these risky bets.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, both of those things were true. And
one seems a little more risky than the other to me. I mean, I just don't think that there's a huge class of people who are like, wow, I just got away with just now barely being able to pay for my mortgage. That gives me a free license to just go hog wild. People aren't in that business. They're in the business of living and doing whatever their job is,
right,
and just being able to show up at their homes.
Right, right. No, but you're absolutely right. These banks, they do become addicted to risk, and they become contemptuous of safety. I mean, that's another aspect of it. I mean, if you look at the history of a company like Lehman Brothers, they were so obsessed with chasing yield and making money and making high profits that they had essentially hawked everything that they had, everything in the house that was of any value. They had taken to the pawn shop, essentially turned it into cash and invested it in something. And they were so completely, bereft of any kind of liquidity of their own, that every single day in the last year of their existence, they were having to go out and borrow between $100 and $200 billion of one-day rolling loans just to keep their doors open, to meet their daily obligations. You know, so they were constantly playing this game where, you know, we're going to borrow, we have $700 billion of loans and investments out there, and we got to pay them off every day. But you know, we don't have enough money to do that, so we got to keep borrowing money, and it just becomes like this crazy crack addict way of living. And we did nothing to change that mentality because now we've made it easier for these guys to get money. We've allowed them to take crappy collateral to the Fed and hand it over and get cash and, you know, in return. And so we've encouraged the same kind of addictive, risky behavior, which is nuts.
Unbelievable. Well, Matt Taibbi, another great piece in Rolling Stone magazine. And thanks for keeping it, this whole question of TARP alive, because maybe the next round they'll do it differently. I'm a little skeptical, but I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sam. I appreciate it.
Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone magazine. Folks, remember, you can support this program and all that we do here by becoming a member at majority.fm. There are other ways you can support us. You give us a good review on iTunes. That always helps. It raises our numbers. You can buy coffee at justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, 10% off the coupon code.
Is this leave a comment on our iTunes
week? Yeah, you want it to be? Let's start it tomorrow. We'll start it tomorrow. You can, of course, if you buy crap through Amazon, buy it through our link, majority.fm/support the show. It is, we cannot do this show without your support. And to the extent that we do this show now, which is pretty extensive. I had another conversation with somebody over the weekend where they're like, you do how much? 5 days a week, 90 minutes a day. That's crazy. It is a little bit crazy and a little bit obsessive.
I think sometimes a lot more than 90 minutes a day.
That's true. Today might be one of those days, but we're going to take a break. Head into the better half of the program. The number is 646-257-3920 if you want to be a part of it. 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. We'll be back with more after this.